It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
From the Fox News Podcast Network, I'm Dana Perino, and everything will be okay. Welcome back to another episode of Everything Will Be Okay. This week, I'm joined by my friend and Fox News colleague, whose work ethic and endurance in and out of the wrestling ring go unmatched. Tyrus is a man of many titles, from father to professional wrestler to podcast host to panelist on Gutfeld. And now he's adding best-selling author to his championship belt. In his memoir, Just Tyrus, he gives us a raw, honest, and heartfelt glimpse into his life. There's a lot of fun in this book. There's a lot of heart and life in this book. I absolutely loved it. I read it in one day. I can't recommend it highly enough. He shares that even in the midst of joy, heartbreak, and unexpected detours and disappointments, he's still Just Tyrus. And Tyrus is pretty great. Tyrus, you're joining the Everything Will Be Okay podcast. I'm excited to have you.
I'm excited to be here and just a scotch nervous.
Why are you nervous?
It's Dana Perino.
Like, what's the most nervous event you've ever done? Like, what's the most nervous you've ever been?
Oh, that's such a good question. What is the most nervous thing I've ever done? Oh, man.
I'll tell you mine.
Probably my first wrestling match where I was walking out in spandex in front of thousands of people.
That would do it for me too.
I was pretty, it like all day was like, I'm fine. And then like, oh boy, like my heart was pounding and like, I was thinking about running the other direction. It was crazy.
So mine, oh my gosh, I think I might've been wearing this exact dress. I did, for charity, I did Celebrity Jeopardy.
Oh, you're smart.
And this was like 2011, 2012, and it was in Washington, D.C. Now, remember, at that point, I had been the White House press secretary. I had answered questions in front of the world. I had done the most nervous I have ever been in my life is doing Jeopardy. I sweated through the dress. I was standing on a box that was like probably like a 4 or 5 inch box, and I was in 4 inch heels. And I was standing next to Kareem Abdul-Jabbar.
Oh, wow. Yeah, he's tall.
So not there was that intimidation, but also just to have your intellect and your knowledge on full display, or lack thereof, on full display for everyone to see. I just, that was bad for me.
But you killed it.
No, I was leading going into the first commercial break, and then I fell apart in the second half.
Yeah, it happens.
But that's the most nervous I've ever been.
Yeah, I was... Dusty Rhodes, rest his soul, didn't help me. Like, he was literally like the Funkasaurus character. Was not in my wheelhouse. Like, I was not a dancer. I never danced when I was even in the clubs. When I was a bouncer, I nodded my head. And I had been training to be this killer. You know, for a year and a half, I was getting ready. I wrote this whole thing, and it was called The House of Pain, and had these matches on superstars, and people were terrified of me, and I was doing my thing that I was trained to do. And I was... Then I made a joke in the locker room, and Vince McMahon just happened to be walking by, and I heard his very distinctive laugh. He's got the ha ha. It's like a chuckle. It's not evil, but if there was ever an evil laugh, it would be in the running. And I thought, oh, all right, I made the old man laugh. And Triple H, who was spearheading my TV debut and stuff, my debut, came up to me one day with like his face was as white as a ghost, and he was like, hey. I was like, hey, because we're getting ready to debut next week. And he's like, did you make a joke or something in front of the boss? I said, I'm not in front of him. I think he walked by. I said, why? He goes, well, he thinks you're a pretty funny guy. I said, yeah, a lot of guys do in the locker room. It's just, you know, right. Locker room stuff. He's like, oh, he thinks you're a really funny guy. I was like, well, how funny? He's like, coming out to the ring dancing funny. And I was like, what does dancing have to do with funny? And he was like, he likes to dance. It makes him laugh. You made him laugh, so he assumes you like to dance. And I was like, what can we do? And he's like, I don't know. Give me some time. So, and I was like, oh no, I was having a heart attack. Like, oh no, what? And I said, can I go to Dusty Rhodes, who was my mentor, and like he was like a father figure for me. And I went down in there, and I was like, what do I do? He's trying to make me dance, and he was like, well, baby, you're being punished for my sins. And I was like, okay, well, what do you need to do? I do not want to dance. And he says, well, you're gonna have to learn to dance, because if the boss wants you to dance, you got to dance. And I was like, having a hyper, you think you sweat? I was covered. And this is just me and Dusty Rhodes alone in an arena. And I'm like, I'm not doing this. I'm not dancing. That's not who I am. And he was like, well, so who are you going to have to be?
In spandex?
It would eventually be. But on that day, I was not wearing spandex in my personal time. And although I'm sure they're comfortable, but it's just not my thing. I know wrestlers in the 80s used to wear cowboy boots and spandex. Again, just not my cup of tea. So, he said, give me your hand. And I said, for what? And he's like, we're going to dance. And he had the sound guy hit the lights, and he turned on Moves Like Jagger. And I was really getting upset. Like, I was the closest I was ever to punching somebody I cared deeply for. And he made me dance with him. And it was like 45 minutes, because I fought it with everything I had. And the only thing was like Morgan Freeman coming over. Like, I wish I could say Tyrus fought the good fight, but eventually you just, anybody who laughs and is that much fun in what he does, you end up, so I ended up dancing with him. It took so long at the time, my son and his uncle had came to pick me up at the thing. And then my son and them were just standing there. And they come from a strong wrestling tradition family, you know, like they break wood with their hands. And I'm dancing. So, and then it just happened. And next thing I know, they're like, you're debuting and you're going to come out as Heavy D was the name they wanted me to come out to. And Dana, I was hyperventilating in the corner, like, think of something. Think, you got to get out of this. There's 20,000 people and you're going to come out as Heavy D? Like, Heavy G just died. Like, you don't. Oh, no, Heavy D just died. I was going to be Heavy G. That's how traumatic this was. I'm like, I'm not doing this. Plus, I'm dieting. This isn't fair. And the announcer walked up to me, and they never, just for some reason, said, hey, what am I calling you tonight? And I just was like, Funkasaurus. And he's like, what? That was approved? Yeah. I'm from Planet Funk. I'm the Funkasaurus. And he was like, All right. So he went out there and he did it. That wasn't so bad. And I went out and did the thing. But I mean, my heart.
Well, this is, I'm glad you told the story, because I wanted to have you on the podcast to talk about your book, Just Tyrus.
And I do talk about
that
in my book.
That story is in the book. I was honored to read an early copy of the book before it was even in print. I got the electronic copy in January. It was a weekend. I read it in a day. I couldn't put it down. I loved it. I kept sending you messages. That this line's great. Oh, this is so good. Oh, wow. I can't believe this happened. Oh, my gosh. Your book is so good. And I finished it, and I have been raving about it ever since. And I encourage anyone who listens to this podcast or sees Tyrus on any of his multiple shows or listen to his podcast. You think you know Tyrus, and then you read this book, and it is so moving and honest and action packed. It is funny. It is also astounding. To look back, to know you now as a successful guy, and to be able to go back and understand all the things that you went through to get you to this point. And I also know you as a dad, and a little Georgie, who she kind of likes me, I think.
Yeah, just a scotch. Just a scotch.
You were on before, and we talked about what it's like to raise daughters in this time, and how you can raise them with confidence and to have the grace and dignity. And the belief that they can do anything that they want to do. But let's go back to the beginning. I don't know how far back I want to go, and you don't have to give away the whole story, but a couple of things stuck out to me. One is your leaving of Massachusetts. And another one, I thought there's the scene of being on your bike in California with the sax, catching snakes.
Yeah.
I think that's an interesting trajectory for me, to like where you went and then where you were, so very vulnerable in this very vulnerable situation, to a place of love, to then being uprooted again, but yet figuring out a way to survive and to be considered a leader that somebody, that people could turn to and like, wow, that guy's cool. That guy's big. That guy's smart. That guy's brave.
Yeah. Well, first of all, thank you so much for the kind words, and it's very humbling, and it's hard not to get emotional. I really appreciate. Excuse me, I'm sorry.
It's all right.
You know, everyone has a story. You know, when you tell yours, you think, you don't think it ever. You sometimes don't think that your life has as much meaning as you would like it to be. And one of the scary things about it is when you put it on paper and you present it to people, it exposes you. And then when someone validates you, especially someone like you, who I respect so much, some of my own weaknesses stand out because not having those kind of people in my life, there was never an attaboy or a good job. It was just, they had other stuff going on.
That was just survival for you.
So, as I get myself together here, being in that, and I hate calling it a foster home because it wasn't. It was the only home I really ever knew. So, and they were so protective of me. Like, it changed my life. Like, that part of my life was probably the most critical because I was going the wrong way really fast.
Remind everyone how old you were?
I was, when I went to them, I think I was 5 and a half.
Okay, like, and you had a little brother.
And a little brother, yeah, he was 2 years younger than me. So he didn't really, he still hadn't, he was always kind of protected. You know, like I did a really good job and my mother did a good job, but he just was too little to kind of see everything that was going on. He obviously knew that stuff wasn't right, you know, with the screaming and crying a lot, but he was just younger. So when he went, it was a lot easier for him to transition, you know, and it was very difficult for me. And they went through hell with me. I was not a lovable kid. I was a violent kid. I was aggressive and I was smart. And that is not a good combination. So,
and you got bored easily.
Very easily. Mm-hmm. And things like timeouts didn't work with someone like me. When you put a child like me in timeout, that was me to marinate and figure out what I could do next time not to get caught. So timeouts meant nothing to
me. That's like my sister, Angie. My mom would send her to her room and she'd say, good, I love my room.
Yeah. I wouldn't even say that. I would just glare at you as I walked to my room and plotted. Mm-hmm. And recently I did that to my daughter and she gave me that look. And I said, I know that look. But and then one day becomes like normal and the nightmares go away and the bedwetting stops and you become a family, you know, and like I was playing hockey and I went to, with my foster dad, I would go to his barbershop on the weekends and I was his guy, you know, and it was just, I had this bond and then, you know, just life has a way of changing and it just.
Because your mom gets in touch and says, I'm ready.
Yeah.
And
she graduated from nursing school. Mm-hmm. She, we were separated and she went to school and she got her stuff together, her life together. And she had an opportunity to go start over and she chose to bring us back. Mm-hmm. And so then we went from there to a very different world in California, like a very conservative household. Everyone had a role, had a job. You didn't cuss at the dinner table. It was structured. You wore a suit and tie to church. Like they were extremely structured and very loving home. My mother's home, I'm not saying she wasn't loving. It just was different. So I could tell they were upset. I could tell they were hurting, but they were just so strong about being parents, and their issues didn't matter. Like, their hearts were broken, but they wouldn't let me see it. I could sense it, but I knew that they were saying, I'm just going to visit my mom for a little while and see how it goes. But I had, by that point in my life.
You knew, like in the book, you write that you're like, you know that this is it.
Yeah, I knew it was it. They always, phone calls. It was always like, oh, call me, we'll stay in touch. And by that time, that was my third probably, call me, we'll stay in touch kind of thing. So I got really hip to it. So it was a huge shock coming to California. And I adjusted. That's the one thing I always had to do. I had to adjust and figure things out. There wasn't going to be a bedtime. My mother worked nights. She had roommates. You know, they're young. She was young. They liked to party and do what young people think about, you know. And that was very different for me. So I kind of had to be the adult.
Mm-hmm. We'll be right back with more of this interview after this.
The Will Kane Show is now dropping 5 episodes a week. Join Fox and Friends weekend host Will Kane as he tackles the latest headlines from his unique perspective, along with thought-provoking interviews with leading figures and live calls from viewers and listeners. Listen wherever you download your favorite podcasts.
Tell the story about getting the snakes. Because you always loved animals from a small, when you were a young age, you loved animals.
Yeah, like one of the things was, if it was very brief, I didn't talk a lot. Some things in the books I left out just because it was just, it would have been way too many pages. But one positive experience with my, biological father's side of the family is that my grandfather was a horse rancher. He raised horses and cows. So I spent a lot of time on the farm. And there was nothing that I wasn't going to climb, crawl. And he had this Morgan stallion that nobody went around because he was super aggressive and he was a stud. So mm-hmm. That was his job. I escaped at three and went into his stall and basically climbed all over him, pulled his tail, pulled his everything you could imagine to be pulled on a horse. I pulled it, crawled up on his mane, had my thumb in his ear, like driving him absolutely nuts, but he didn't touch me. So I was completely harmless. Uh-huh. And I had to be checked every day I came in the house for some critter, either stuffed in a diaper or I used to wear overalls all the time. I was a farmer. I didn't wear a t-shirt, just overalls. I was a tough guy. I was a tough kid. And we'd have a frog or something stuck. If you ever seen Old Yeller, the Kurt Russell's little character, that was me. Something was always there. So when I got to California and I was given a bike and they had this place called The Wash, you could just ride anywhere in California. You could just take off, and we called it The Wash. And it was like mountains and a river, and the river would dry up in the summertime. So you'd just be down there, and there was every kind of snake you could imagine. And we were the snake wranglers, not really original, but that's what we came up with. It was me and like 5 other kids. And we would get up at 9 in the morning, have a sack lunch, hop on our bikes, and we were gone. And our only rule was be back by sundown. And one occasion we had enough gopher snakes and king snakes to probably start our own snake store. But on one particular occasion, and I actually got a whipping for this, but left that part out. In California, we have palm trees everywhere. Yeah. And when they fall, they lay flat and they're like things like to hide under them all the time. So we flipped them over to try to catch snakes and lizards and rats and mice to feed our snakes. So we flip it over and lo and behold, curled up in a perfect ball is this baby rattlesnake. Yeah, that's what everyone else said but me. And I was like, oh, we got to catch it. So I ran as fast as I could, hopped on my bike, rode to my house. My mom was sleeping because she worked nights. Took her best pair of salad prongs, hopped out, rode back, and everyone was still standing there. And they were like, has he moved? He was like, no, he hasn't moved. I took a pair of salad prongs. These are the old, old school ones. Clamped it on his little head, picked him up, put him in a bag, tied it in knots, put it on my bike, and rid home like I was the king. I just conquered the world and put it in a glass aquarium in my bedroom. Where it
so that
struck
story,
me
I liked it for several reasons. I just felt like it was a metaphor for other things that were going to happen in your life. So, sort of against all odds, as people read the book, you'll see that Tyrus, after a fashion, because of one of his mom's boyfriends, I guess even then husband, I guess.
Yeah, eventually they got married.
Tyrus in high school is staying on friends' couches.
Yeah,
and I was very touched by something you say in the book where you talk about started to recognize the look from the parents or the sort of the some of the words about like, okay, I got to go find another place.
Yeah,
you then get to college, and there's a scene there before we talk about your other professional pursuits. And then I don't want to just be specific about the book because there's some lessons in here that I think everybody that listened to this particular podcast will like to learn. And part of it is dealing with peer pressure and then dealing with disappointment. So on the peer pressure front, I remember a story in the book. You're in college, a lot of people doing drugs or dealing drugs, and you're uncomfortable. And how did you get yourself out of that situation? If people are in a, you could tell the story, but I'm trying to think about people that end up just sucked into a bad situation, or maybe they run with the wrong crowd, or they make one bad decision and they don't know how to get out of it. But you did.
I think the short of it is, it really comes down to who you identify with. And I identified with men I saw on TV. And my hero was this little guy, David Banner, who would turn into Lou Ferrigno when his problems arose. But he was what they call a reluctant hero. And he always kind of did the right thing. And I watched a lot of TV, and it was always the guys who kind of seemed to do the right thing. And that kind of stuck with me. And I also grew up seeing the results of what drugs do to you and what type of people come around with drugs and stuff like that. So I always was better than them in my mind, especially with my stepdad. He did drugs and stuff, so I was always better than him because I didn't. And then here I am doing it. And I never did any hardcore drugs, but I was selling them. Mm-hmm. And I think the thing that really makes you is when there comes a moment when you're in the moment and you're seeing all the benefits of doing what you're doing. And then there's going to come a time when someone's going to show you a mirror and you're not going to like what you see. And you either become something new or you make a change. And for me, being called a drug dealer was just like being called the N-word to me because of all the negative stuff I saw it. And when it hit me that that's what I was and that's what I was doing, no matter how I tried to clean it up or make it cool or like I'm doing it for books and all this, you put all kinds of bells and whistles on what you're doing. And when I really realized that's what I was doing, I just stopped. I was like, I'm not doing this anymore. I'm out because I don't want, this is not what I want to be. And it took just being real with yourself, because we love to trick ourselves into like justifying everything we do. It's not my fault. And I always have my out. You know, I always say, well, it's because I'm black and this, that, and I have to do this because the man's holding us down. And that's what a golden ticket for excuses. And for me, I just wanted to be more. I didn't want to be that.
That's another thing in the book that I think there's so many funny parts too. I mean, you got up to some things.
Yeah.
And the other thing I talk about in my book and that I wondered if you could explain here is how to best bounce back from disappointment and to build that resiliency. Because over and over again in this book, you have these opportunities and then they are yanked away from you, or you did something that caused them to go away. And that was both on the football field, at the wrestling place, and then also even with Snoop.
Yep.
And so over and over again, you're learning that lesson. What would you advise people on that?
I think you have to listen to yourself. If you're honest with yourself when something goes wrong and you don't play the noise, you don't listen to the excuses, you know, because a lot of times your friends will say things to you that's not helping you, especially if they're, I call them wingmen. Mm. They're just there to tell you like, hey, I mean, one of my best friends who I love to death. A girl called me fat at the club one night when I was in college, and it was a 320-pound lineman, so it wasn't completely unrun. And he's like, oh, it's just baby fat. I said, bro, I'm 23 years old. That type of advice doesn't help you. And that's where and you make jokes like that, but when it comes to life of real decisions and you surround yourself with people like that and you don't take responsibility for what you've done, like every time I got fired in every situation or let go or cut, if I was being real with myself, I knew why. It was something that I did or an excuse that I gave them. So I talk about the best advice ever. It's not what happens to you. It's your reaction that you're judged by. And my reactions to myself were always honest. Yeah. I never lied to myself. Like that's the one thing.
And what do you
thing.
Think that comes from? Like how did you... I mean, I guess all of us do know deep down, you know, the truth.
Right.
But you in the book, I feel like over and over again, you see that you're like, well... That was dumb, and I have to face the consequences.
For a long time, I was all I had.
Yeah.
So I was my own best friend when it came mm-hmm. to me. Like, I knew what I had to do. When you are the protector, when you're the one who's in charge of your brother and your mother and making sure you're safe, the one person you have to count on is yourself. I woke up without alarm clocks for school because I knew that I had to get, I wake up 5 minutes before I was supposed to. I still do it to this day.
Me too.
Because I know that I'm not going to have an alarm clock cost me my opportunity. So I rely on myself. And I think when you look at whatever the situation is, whenever you get punched in the mouth, as soon as you start saying, look what they made me do, or they did it because of this and that, you're only spending more time laying down.
It's interesting. My friend Ingrid had some great advice for me last year. I was going through one particular thing, making a change in my life. And I told her that I felt like I was on a high wire without a net. And she said, but you are the net.
Exactly.
And I'm like, I'm almost 50. I just realized what she meant by that. And it really made me think like, oh, you're right. I guess I have been doing it. I've been paying my bills and getting to work on time and having a successful relationship with my husband and keeping my family together. I'm like, yeah, I am the net. And you are so the net.
Yeah, you have to be. When you rely on other people, even the best, even the person who loves you the most is going to disappoint you, because at the end of it, they have to take care of themselves too.
And I love you as a father. Like, so you are the dependable one, right? That's the one now. Is that a role that you love?
I love it, but it was hard. I'm the first one to admit that I did not start out Father of the Year.
Right.
Not even a little bit. I tried to run from it. I tried to deny it. I was not ready for the responsibility. I was paranoid because I had no idea how to be a father. And I had no reference. And it wasn't until I actually was like holding my children and looking at them, and I just realized that like all they need is me to be me. I can't be anything else but me, and it's good enough, because they smile and laugh when you pick them up. Mm-hmm. They don't care if you're not the world champ. They don't care if you are in between greatness chases or whatever. They just want you there.
Yep. They don't care you're on TV.
No. My daughters do not care. It's like, hey, come watch this movie. Matter of fact, Georgie this weekend wanted to watch one of my movies. Mm-hmm. And I said, okay, you pick it out. And she picked The Beast in the Water. I die in that movie in a fight scene.
Oh,
and yeah, spoiler alert. And I kept trying to tell her, you know, it's a movie, it's an action movie, and you know, we do this, that, whatever. And I said, and explained to her how everything happened, and then when I got shot, mm-mm, my daughter was just boo-hooing.
Yeah.
She was just like, did you live, Dad? And I was like, I think I'm sitting right here with you, kid. But I was like,
yeah,
actually, I didn't die all the way. Like, I'm in the sequel. There's not gonna be a sequel. I said, but yeah, I was still breathing. They just didn't know.
Uh-huh.
And she was like, okay, because you realize how important you are to them. And I'm not, and I'm proud to say I'm not my kids' friends. You know, I'm not even a little bit. Like, I wanted to be their friends in the beginning, but that's poor parenting. So I had to learn as I went, but I love the challenge.
Did Snoop have a chance to look at your book yet?
Yeah, I sent it to him. The two people I sent it to was you, and I sent it to Snoop and his manager, Kevin. And I said, Kevin, you probably have to read it to him, like making jokes and stuff. But I underestimated him, because he reads everything.
Mm-hmm.
And when he sent the blurb, like, again, even if you don't want to read one page of the book, I would argue that I have the greatest blurbs in the history of books. I don't even think Shakespeare could top this one. I have Dana Perino and Snoop Dogg on the same page. I mean, that, you know.
And tell everyone what Snoop said about that.
He just...
Didn't he say, that's so you?
Yeah, he said that's 100%. He messaged me and he was like, Dana Perino, man, that is you. Like, only you would bring the hood and the White House together. And I said, she's tougher than you think, boss. She's tougher than you think.
You know, I love good books. I love great stories. I love you. I love working with you. And what a great friendship, you know, that we have. And you know, Fox has provided both of us a lot of opportunities that neither of us started out here.
No.
And, you know, and Greg, I like the story that you tell about your first sort of encounters with Greg when I think he had you on one night, and then he said, why don't you come and be here? He's got an eye for talent. And obviously you're successful in lots of different areas, movies, wrestling, writing and parenting. But, tell us a little bit about your experience here at Fox and what you think of that.
So Gutfeld and I, we started off like, it was weird. He messaged me. He liked something on Twitter, and I made a joke at somebody. I think I was dealing with some kind of troll, and I said something piffy, they would say. And he was like, that was pretty funny. I was like, oh, thanks, man. Appreciate it. And I was like, hey, aren't you the guy from Red Eye or something like that? And he was like, yeah, hey, I got a new show. Gutfeld show. Would you like to come on as a guest sometime? And I was like, yeah, right. Fox News and me, whatever, yo. Like, not happening. And he was like, no, seriously. And I was like, okay, obviously this is some weird guy trying to get a wrestler on a show to like try to make fun of us or make it look stupid, because unfortunately that's what happens a lot of times with wrestlers are kind of looked down upon. And I was like, he didn't pick the wrong one. So, but he asked me to come out. I did the show, and Arroyo Grande, I think, was my first topic about her stealing donuts with her boyfriend.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I like, well, you know, right. Sugar tooth, a lot like crack, man. You just can't, you know, sometimes you got to go for it. And during the commercial break, he was like, that was pretty funny. I would love to, if you were here in New York, I'd have you as a co-host. And I'm like, well, I don't live in New York. You know, and I'm always.
If so funny. When I first got the opportunity to be on The Five, I said, but I don't live in New York.
Yeah.
So it's weird the way that you say that. And then I called Peter to tell him about The Five, and he goes, oh, congratulations. I was like, what are you talking about? He goes, this is what you always wanted. This is what you always wanted to do. And it takes sometimes somebody else to tell you that.
Yeah, Greg kept telling me this is what
I was like dealing with logistics in my head.
Yeah, I just didn't think, I didn't see how it was going to work. And Gutfeld just would not.
Yeah.
He's like, okay, tell you what. Then I did. He's like, how about once a month? And I said, once a month I can do. It doesn't hurt, because I got to work. I travel. I wrestle on the weekends and stuff with TNA and stuff. I'm always I'm auditioning, you know, because I'm going to be a star. And it just turned into, but how about every 2 weeks? You know, and I was like, all right. And then the police segment happened. And that was tough for me, because I didn't know really what. I had been on both sides of the fence, and I wasn't really sure.
Police?
It was, I think it was in Louisiana. It was the Sterling situation. There was a rash of like videos, you know, between cops and suspects and stuff. And Gutfeld asked me about it. And he was, you know, he sent, because you get your rundown or whatever. And I was like, man, I don't know if I want to talk about this, because I got street cred and I got my own stuff, and I've been on the wrong side of it and the right side of it. I have friends that are cops, and there's a couple police that I wish I could see them in a small room sometime. So I was just kind of like back and forth on it. But Greg's like, just be yourself, man. I'm not asking you to say anything, which is something that Fox does not get enough credit for. One of the things that really bothered me about the recently Jen Psaki had made that comment about our very own dear sweet Peter Ducey about how like Fox writes questions for you. No.
Never.
No. It, you bring what you're going to bring, and it's not always agreeable. I don't always agree with Greg. I'm in my own lane. Yep. But and I ended up at some point during the conversation, I just said, it's about compliance, and resisting arrest doesn't make you Rosa Parks. It makes you a criminal. And it went viral, but the statement was profound, and I showed both sides of it. And that's pretty much what, at that point, Greg was like, you have to do this. He's like, I don't know what, like, wrestling, your wrestling career is great and all that, and you could probably still do that. He goes, but you have a voice here, and you need to. So Gutfeld, I mean, I'm not saying he convinced me, but, like, he was one, his voice was always like, you need to do
he
this.
He was right.
You know, this isn't. You aren't just a, quote, pretty face. He goes, you have something to go. And I was just thinking.
Did he call you a pretty face?
Yeah, you know,
I'm
going to
give him hell tonight when I see him.
You know he's creepy. He says, you see on the show, he always says little things where I go, why'd I walk into that?
Well, the book is called Just Tyrus. It is so good.
Thank you.
It's a great length. I honestly, if you have a flight, you'll finish it in a day or two because you won't be able to put it down. It's an amazing story. Did you read the audiobook yourself?
I'm doing the audiobook myself because they wanted another guy to do it, but he was like, I can't talk like him.
Right. So you have to do it yourself. So if you have a commute, you know, get the audiobook, because it makes such a difference when it's your own personal story for you to do that. My last question for you is, do you believe that everything will be okay?
Oh, 100%. Yeah. And I take offense sometimes because your book does say to young ladies, but I read said book and I read it to my daughter. And what I loved it so much. I did a video for you, and I didn't think that it was a ladies' book. And I'm like, everything will be okay, guy. You know, and then I realized that I was like, not, and I said, listen, I'm not a daughter or a little sister, but I'm a parent of daughters.
It really is great feedback about it, because like Trey Gowdy said that as a dad, as he said, one that he learned a lot. There's a lot of mentoring advice in there. He's like, I learned a lot for himself.
Same
but he
thing.
Said, as a dad and as a manager, as a husband of a wife, she's had an amazing teaching career. That it was good for them as well. Because the one thing I don't want people to do, and I can see this what you're doing with Georgie, is there's so many young women who are American and educated and loved by their parents, and they're just racked with anxiety. And they're afraid to take a risk, whether in their personal life or at work. They're in too much of a hurry, and you can worry your young life away. And I just don't want that for people.
No, and one of the things I do, and I only exasperated after your book, was that I play the bad guy with Georgie. Like this weekend, she was like, Dad, I'm going to do 10 cartwheels in a row. Ugh, you're just a little girl. There's no way you can do that. I'm sorry. Please sit down. You're going to hurt yourself. Fine, I'll do 15. Oh, let me get a bag of ice. And then she'll do 15 and 16 and 17. And she'll be like, now what?
Well, she's like, thriving.
Yes.
And so. you're a wonderful father. It's amazing all that you have achieved at I'm going to say relatively young age.
Yeah, okay.
Because
sure.
You've got a lot ahead of you, but to know where you started in life.
Yeah.
And where you are now, you are an incredible human, and I'm proud to know you.
Thank you so much.
All right,
really
thanks, Tyrus. Make sure you subscribe to this series wherever you download podcasts and leave a rating and review. I'm Dana Perino. Everything will be okay.
I'm Guy Benson. Join me weekdays at 3 p.m. Eastern as we break down the biggest stories of the day with some of the biggest newsmakers and guests. Listen live on the Fox News app or get the free podcast at GuyBensonShow.com.
Listen to Fox News podcast shows ad-free on Fox News Podcast Plus, on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music with your Prime membership, or follow wherever you get your podcasts.